From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Happy Saturday. It is August 22nd. Well, on today's show, New York's 19th Congressional District Representative Josh Riley gives us the latest on the Farm Bill, the federal policy that sets national agriculture policy. We'll hear more from the Congress member in just a few. We'll get a close-up look at timber rattlesnakes and learn how collecting data on these snakes help inform wildlife management. We'll hear from WVIA's Kat Bolas and Discover NEPA's Don Jacobs. Plus, the Delaware Highlands Conservancy is getting ready for fall. We'll hear from the team on what programs to expect this September. All of that and a deep dive with StarTalk's Keith Hubbard on the most common astronomy myths. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Linda Kenyon. President Trump is saying thank you to the U.S. Supreme Court for allowing his ballroom construction to continue, at least for now.
I just want to thank the Supreme Court and the Chief Justice, and we have a ruling that it's proceed. When they say proceed, I think that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Nothing's easy today.
The president is referring to a temporary order signed by Chief Justice John Roberts letting work continue as the court considers an emergency appeal. The administration was challenging lower court rulings that would have forced a halt to above-ground construction of the project because Trump did not first get congressional approval. The president was speaking in South Carolina, campaigning on behalf of Darlene Graham for the U.S. Senate. The window is closing for registering to vote in some of the last statewide primary elections of the year. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang has this rundown of the upcoming deadlines.
If you are eligible to vote in next month's primary election in Delaware or Massachusetts, today is the last day to register online or in person or to stop by a post office to get your mail-in application postmarked. New Hampshire also has a statewide primary in September. Mail-in applications in that state must be received by Wednesday, August 26. And in-person registration will be available at the polls on New Hampshire's primary day, September 8th. If you're already registered, election officials recommend confirming your status and contact information before the deadline by visiting your state's official election website. Officials can remove your name from voter rolls, especially if you recently moved, changed your name, or haven't voted in a while. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News.
Big cuts are coming for some states that use water from the Colorado River. Alex Hager from member station KJZZ reports Arizona will take the biggest reductions, but officials there are still expressing relief.
The federal government could have cut up to 40% of the water supply for Arizona, California, and Nevada, but negotiated with those states to reduce their take by 20%. However, this plan will only last for 2 years. Arizona's top water negotiator Tom Buschatsky says the state could still sue to protect its water rights in the future.
Arizona can challenge actions taken in subsequent guidelines that do not comply with the law.
Deeper cuts to demand could be needed when the new rules expire in 2028. Water supplies have been shrinking for more than 2 decades as a result of drought and climate change. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Phoenix.
Cattle ranchers in northern Mexico are preparing to resume cattle exports to the U.S. as a year-long ban ends in just 2 days. The ban was imposed due to a parasite outbreak affecting cattle industries on both sides of the border. In addition, President Trump has announced his administration will temporarily roll back tariffs against beef imports by 25% to help American consumers cope with the high prices. You're listening to NPR.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Kimberly Izar. Some good news for families and child care providers in Sullivan County. The Child Care Assistance Program plans to reopen on September 16th. This is the state program that provides families with child care assistance to help pay for the high cost of child care. The program has been closed since last July, more than a year, due to a lack of available funding. Here's Dan Hoos, Sullivan County's communications director, with more.
It'll be a first-come, first-served basis, so you'll want to be making that application on September 16th or there or as close thereafter. Again, you can do it earlier now, but if it were me, I'd aim for that opening time. It's September 16th at 9 a.m., and our folks are going to continually monitor funding as we authorize cases so that we try to mitigate before we suddenly find out we're out of money.
Hoos says that applications will not be accepted in bulk as it has been in previous years.
Each applying family has to submit their own application to the Child Care Assistance Program. It can't be done on behalf of anyone else. Each applying family also has to complete an interview and submit all the documentation required to make an eligibility determination, which we have 30 days to make. So, and we'll be putting out more information very, very shortly about what you'll have to provide in terms of documentation.
The county's program nearly quadrupled the amount of children it served in recent years after Governor Kathy Hochul expanded eligibility for the program. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at cfosrny.org. And from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. The Farm Bill sets the foundation for federal agriculture and food policy for the country. It also supports things like nutrition assistance, crop insurance, and conservation efforts. And the last Farm Bill was passed in 2018. And has received several one-year extensions now until September 30th. Right now, the bill is stuck in the Senate Agriculture Committee. I caught up with Congressmember Josh Riley, who represents the 19th Congressional District, about the bill. The 19th District is the second largest congressional district in New York State, spanning from the Finger Lakes all the way down to the Hudson Valley regions, including Sullivan, Delaware, and parts of Ulster counties. I want to shift gears a little bit and wanting to talk a little bit about the Farm Bill, which is the federal legislation that sets national agriculture policy for our listeners. Would love to just hear a little bit about what the latest is in terms of conversations in Washington about this, because I know that here in our region, that is definitely something that people are looking to.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really proud to have been the only Democrat in the New York delegation to vote for the Farm Bill. Not only that, I helped write a lot of it. All of the provisions that I wrote were rooted in stories that I heard directly from folks across this district, including, for example, just the other day, I was up at the Otsego County Fair, and I talked to a gentleman who bought his dairy farm in the 1980s, and he was telling me the milk prices haven't been adjusted the right way since then, decades ago. I have a bipartisan bill that got included in the Farm Bill to fix the milk pricing formula. Talked to a lot of folks, the cost, the input costs are just so high in operating our family farms. And so I worked on a bipartisan bill to update irrigation systems, bring down costs for farmers, and while doing it, create a bunch of really good manufacturing jobs here in upstate New York, building these efficient irrigation systems. One of the things I'm actually most proud of that I included in the Farm Bill, one of the leading causes of death and serious injuries on our farms across upstate New York, it's hilly here, are tractor rollovers. And a lot of people don't appreciate that a lot of tractors don't have roll bar protection on them. So I have a bipartisan bill that will retrofit tractors to make them more safe. And what's really special about this is that retrofitting program is actually run out of Bassett in Cooperstown in our district. And so this is really, for me, this was really about putting upstate first, putting upstate agriculture first, having hyper-local projects included in this big national piece of legislation. So the latest on it is that it looks like it has stalled in the Senate. There is a the main debate right now is trying to get a delay of some of the cuts to SNAP benefits. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get that. But this is a piece of legislation that our ag community across upstate New York deserves. They need it. And I'm going to continue to fight for it. And you know, this is an example where I've broken with my own party to do right by upstate New York. Democratic Party bosses and leaders in Washington pushed all the Democrats, whipped all the Democrats to vote against this bill. I voted for it because I work for folks in upstate New York and not party bosses in Washington.
I'm curious to hear what you're hearing from maybe some of the smaller farmers. Some of the criticism that we hear about the bill is that, you know, it's tailored to larger agriculture producers. Are you hearing similar concerns, and kind of how are you bringing that feedback back to Washington?
I haven't been, because the bills that I introduced that got included in this farm bill are specifically tailored to the needs of particular farms across this district. So I'll give you just one example of this. We just had over the spring, the frost wiped out a whole bunch of our specialty crops, apples, and talked to a bunch of folks across the region who lost a lot of their crops. And one of the big problems is the big commodity crops actually have a insurance program that is pretty robust and it's predictable, whereas our small specialty crop growers across upstate New York don't have that. And so one of the things I got included in the farm bill, again, on a bipartisan basis, is disaster assistance that folks can count on so that we're not, every time there's a frost or disaster, trying to chase relief. We were able to get that disaster declaration for this last spring, but we shouldn't be dealing with that stuff for our small growers. After the fact, they should be able to count on it. I'll give you just like one, you know, one other example on this. There's about 450 dairies across this district, 4,500 farms. And one of the biggest challenges our dairy farmers are facing is access to market. So I was really proud to be one of the Democrats to help get whole milk back into our schools. President Trump signed that. And I also have a bipartisan provision in the farm bill that would add yogurt to the Dairy Nutrition Incentive Program, which allows folks who are on SNAP to stretch those dollars by purchasing yogurt made here in upstate New York at Chobani, using the milk that's produced by dairy farmers all across upstate New York. And so from my perspective, my approach to the farm bill was get as much input from as many farmers as possible across this district and make sure I'm addressing their needs in a bipartisan way in this bill. Last thing I'll say on this, I do think, you know, the criticism is right, though, generally with how farm policy has been set in this country for a long time. It's the biggest corporations, the biggest ag monopolies. You know, you think of these corporations like, I don't know, ConAgra and these other ones, these massive monopolies that give a bunch of corporate PAC money to the politicians and then send their lobbyists in to do their bidding. When I asked to get onto the Agriculture Committee, I did that rejecting all corporate PAC money and making clear I am here to fight for small family farmers across upstate New York, and I'll fight against anybody, whether it's the big corporations or my own party, to do it.
You can hear that full interview with Congressmember Josh Riley up on our website. We talk about his reactions to the closure of the care center at Sunset Lake, as well as some of the issues happening at Toronto Reservoir and more. Head on over to our website at wjffradio.org. A new legislative scorecard details how every New York State lawmaker voted on key environmental bills this year. I chatted with Vanessa Fagins-Turner, Executive Director of Environmental Advocates New York, about the tool. The report by environmental justice group Environmental Advocates New York ranks every New York senator and assembly member against their environmental records during the latest state budget. Vanessa Fagins-Turner, Executive Director of Environmental Advocates New York, says she hopes the public uses the scorecard to hold their elected officials accountable.
The reason we do this scorecard is because I like to remind people, legislators have a power that the rest of us mere mortals don't have. They can vote. And what we do with our scorecard is track how everybody we elect to office to serve in New York State uses their vote to protect and conserve our environment, our water, and our clean air and climate. And there are 213 legislators in Albany, And what we did this year was, of course, not only track all of their votes, but we did a little something extra, which was also see how legislators used their public platform to speak out about their views about what happened to the biggest environmental story of the year, the weakening of New York State's climate law. 37 out of 213 legislators earned 3 points, which was as many as you could get, for using their platforms just to say anything about the climate law.
The report released on Monday comes after Governor Kathy Hochul weakened the state's landmark climate law earlier this year. Up next, the latest Star Talk with Keith Hubbard after this short break.
Pints for Public Radio is back. Join Radio Catskill tonight from 6 to 10 p.m. at Rose's Bar and Grill in Berryville. With DJs James Friedman, Tommy Castro, and Woody Wood Jr. spinning tunes, it's an evening of brews, beats, and community spirit, with a portion of the proceeds benefiting Radio Catskill. Come out, drink beer, and support public radio. It's just that simple. Pints for Public Radio, tonight at 6 at Rose's Bar and Grill in Berryville. Cheers!
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Arundhati Roy, author of The God of Small Things. She'll talk to Deepa Fernandez about her memoir, Mother Mary Comes to Me. It's about her childhood in Kerala, India, including her complicated relationship with a brilliant but abusive mother. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Kimberly Izar. You're listening to Farming Country. Well, you know what time it is. This week's Star Talk report from Keith Hubbard.
For Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. On Thursday night, the full moon will drift inside of Earth's shadow, setting up a near-total lunar eclipse. At the time of maximum eclipse, 93% of the moon's disk will be engulfed in Earth's shadow. Most of the contiguous United States will be able to see the whole eclipse, including our listening area. There are two parts to Earth's shadow. The penumbra is the larger part and is formed when Earth blocks a portion of the sun's disk. The smaller umbra is formed when Earth completely blocks the sun's disk. In the umbra, the moon receives no light from the sun and turns a reddish color. The reddish color is a result of the sun's light traveling through our atmosphere and then being refracted around Earth and illuminating the moon. The eclipse will begin at 9:32 p.m. when the moon will begin to slide into Earth's penumbra and will start to darken. The moon will darken from the bottom left to the upper right. At 10:33 p.m., the moon will begin to enter Earth's umbra and turn red. The moon will continue to darken for almost 1 hour and 45 minutes, with the maximum eclipse occurring at 12:12 a.m. At this time, only a tiny sliver of the top of the moon will not be in Earth's shadow. After the time of maximum eclipse, the moon will begin to leave Earth's shadow and will start to brighten. By 3:01 a.m., the moon will have completely left Earth's shadow and the eclipse will be over. Be sure to watch the partial lunar eclipse Thursday night. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard reminding you to keep looking up.
Thanks to Keith for that report. And today we're getting a little bit more time with Star Talk's Keith Hubbard as he joins us with his latest deep dive on the most common astronomy myths floating around. Here's me and Keith.
The first one that we're going to dive into is astrology and astronomy are basically the same thing. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, this is one that I get the most often when, you know, I tell people that I'm into astronomy, is just that confusion between astronomy and astrology, which is understandable. They both have, you know, the same root words, and other sciences, we have biology and geology and ecology. So astrology would be a natural fit, but it's actually astronomy. And, you know, the two words, they have shared roots. Ancient cultures observed the night sky for both the practical purposes, which would be astronomy, but also for the spiritual purposes, which would be astrology. And so that's the big difference, practical versus sort of that in spiritual purpose. So astrology is based on the premise that the movement of celestial bodies has an influence on human affairs. And this uses a subjective approach that cannot be tested, whereas astronomy is the study of objects and phenomena in space. And astronomy uses the scientific method, and it can be tested.
Right. Two completely, completely different fields. But it sounds like, as you said, this is one that you get, you hear pretty often. Well, another one that we're going to talk a little bit about is all stars are white. Tell me a little bit about that. Is that true?
No, that's not true. And it looks like that looking up at the night sky. You see a lot of stars that look white or look bluish white, but the color of a star will depend on its temperature. And so the cooler the star, the redder it will look. And the hotter the star, the bluer it will look. So that's a sort of a backwards thinking from what we're used to think, you know, what we're used to seeing. You know, blue, we usually associate that with cold, and red as something that's hot. But for stars, it's the exact opposite. Red stars are cooler, and white stars or blue stars are hotter stars. And we can look, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to ask if, are there other colors depending, other than, you know, blue, white, red, that a star can be?
So there are different colored stars. So our sun, you know, our star is a yellowish orange color. So it's about an average temperature. But stars can also have more of a blue-green tint as well. There's a star in the constellation Cygnus in Albireo is the name of the star. And that's at the opposite end of Cygnus as the bright star Deneb. If you have a strong telescope and you can zoom in on Albireo, you'll notice that it's not one star, but it's actually two stars. Mm. And that smaller, fainter star is just a really beautiful, like, emerald green color, wow. Kind of a blue green. So that one's really pretty to look in, to view through the telescope. But in terms of the temperature, I don't have the specific temperatures off the top of my head about what they are, but red stars are the cooler ones and blue stars are the hotter ones. And so the colors in between would correspond to, you know, temperatures in between there.
That's fascinating. And does how old a star is in terms of age, does that have any impact in terms of the color, or is it mostly dependent on temperature?
It does have the age does impact the color of the star. Hmm. So as stars age, they're going to cool down. And so you'll see a lot of red stars that are red supergiant stars. So they're at the end of their lives. They've run out of hydrogen and helium in their cores to fuse. So they're starting to swell and expand. And as they're cooling down in temperature, they're turning that red color.
All right, here is another one in terms of myths related to all stars. All stars are the same. Can you kind of talk through that one?
Yes. Yeah. And we kind of mentioned that when we were talking about the temperature and age and that and how they are related. So hotter stars, they are going to be larger and bluer than cooler stars that are in the same stage of the stellar life cycle, that is. So, for example, Rigel, in which we just talked about, it's a blue-white star. It's 65 million miles in diameter compared to our sun, which is a yellowish-orange star, and it's 860,000 miles in diameter. So Rigel is many times bigger than our sun. And then if we look at Betelgeuse, which Betelgeuse as a star at the end of its life is a red supergiant. So it has swollen up many, many times in size, and it's a red color. Betelgeuse is 516 million miles in diameter.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, you know, stars can even be a lot smaller. So neutron stars, which is just, it's the core of a star that's left over, they can be as small as 12 miles in diameter. So about the diameter of a city.
Yes, yes. I think that's a good analogy for people to imagine just how massive this is. I think we have time for maybe one more. And this one is something that I actually feel like I hear often. The brighter the star, the closer it is to Earth. Is this true or is this not true?
Sometimes it can be true, but it's not always true. Most of the time, I would say it's not. When we're looking at the stars in the night sky, to us, they all seem like they're the same distance away. But and we know that that's not true. Some are closer to us than others. So we're looking at the apparent brightness of the stars in our night sky. And that's a combination of the stars' intrinsic brightness and its distance from Earth. And astronomers use a magnitude scale to determine or to classify how bright stars are. And this scale is logarithmic, so it's not linear. So a first magnitude star is going to be 100 times brighter than a sixth magnitude star. So to give you a couple examples, Betelgeuse, it's a magnitude 0.45 star. And Polaris, which is our north star, is fainter, and it's a magnitude 2.1. So Betelgeuse is about 4.5 times brighter than Polaris, even though Betelgeuse and Polaris, they're about the same distance from Earth. Betelgeuse is 427 light years, and Polaris is 431 light years.
Is there something like a tool or a resource or a method that, you know, an average person can use to figure out how close a star is exactly?
There's not really a good tool other than, you know, referencing astronomy books or, you know, different astronomy apps that could have that stellar distance on there, because we can't look at the night sky and say, oh, this star is brighter by such and such amount, so we know it's going to be, you know, this far away compared to the next star.
Gotcha. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. I think that might be all the time we have for today's Astronomy Myths Deep Dives. But Keith, you know, I feel like I just learned so much in the few minutes we chatted. For someone who might be listening and ready to, you know, dive a little bit further, where do you recommend they start? I know we've talked about this before on maybe other shows, but yeah, where should they start?
Start with their interest, because astronomy is a very wide topic. If, you know, if you're really interested in the planets and the planetary science, then, you know, look for, you know, go to the library, check out those books at the library, and, you know, get online, look at information about planets. If it's more, you know, deep sky objects, you know, whether it's, you know, galaxies or, you know, black holes, comets, even the, you know, the age and state of the universe, you know, look that way. But I always tell people to pursue your interest in astronomy, because it's such a big field of study.
Yeah.
That you can't possibly encompass everything all at once. So start with what you're interested in, and you may, as you're reading something about it, it may spark another interest, and then you'll go on from there.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, more about timber rattlesnake hunting, a regulated activity in Pennsylvania, from our partners at WVIA, is up next.
Traveling people pass songs and tunes down the generations more than any other group. Next time on The Bugle of the Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we'll hear British and Irish songs and tunes from and about travellers. Join me, if you'd be so kind, on Sunday afternoon at 3.
On this Old House Radio Hour, don't get eaten alive. The miracle trick that kills mosquitoes without toxic sprays or chemicals.
My approach to gardening is opening up more environment for native insects.
Plus, CNN anchor Casey Hunt takes you inside her landmark mid-century home. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
On this week's Wait, Wait, Jeopardy! Host Ken Jennings admits he never used to like those short interviews with contestants.
Even as a kid, I would sometimes have to leave the room during a boring story. It's like Jeopardy! Stops for a second and Curb Your Enthusiasm begins.
Yes. I'm Peter Sagal. This week, Ken Jennings answers the questions, plus Olivia Munn, EGOT winner Bobby Lopez, and more. Join us for the show without any cringe moments. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Farming Country. Did you know rattlesnake hunting is a regulated activity in Pennsylvania? Coming up on Farming Country, our partners over at WVIA's Good Natured Podcast takes us into the woods with Discover NEPA's Don Jacobs. He's an experienced snake hunter and a member of Pennsylvania's Hunting and Fishing Addicts. Good Natured is WVIA's podcast about the great outdoors in Northeast Pennsylvania. Today, we're going to get a close-up look at timber rattlesnakes and learn how collecting data on these snakes help inform wildlife management. Here's some of that conversation with Kat Bolas, community reporter at WVIA, and Discover NEPA's Don Jacobs.
Welcome to Good Natured, a podcast about positivity and the great outdoors. I'm Kat Bolas from the WVIA news team, and I'm here with Don Jacobs from Discover NEPA. Hello, Don.
Hello, Kat. It's been a while.
It's been a while.
A lot has gone on.
Right? We've been on vacation.
Yeah, you had a really nice travel
trip.
A
very nice trip.
Where did you go again?
St. Martin in the Caribbean.
Yeah. That's nice,
we'll
right?
We'll be back.
Was that your first time in the Caribbean?
Second.
Oh,
yeah.
See, I love the Caribbean.
Me too. Yeah. It's just a different world, and I love it so much. Like, I just floated in the ocean for a week straight.
And there's no better way to be mindless.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, even if the birds get around you, you don't care. Like, it just, there's no better way to be mindless.
Yeah.
I did the same thing. I floated around in the bay a little bit. My sister has a place up in Cape Cod, so we took that. Lucy and I, my fiance and I, took that for a week and just ate tons of seafood. I was really worried about getting iodine poisoning. I ate so much lobster tails and oysters and all that. But so that's sort of behind us. Now we start looking, not that we want to, but towards fall, right?
I mean,
July's over.
July is over, which is wild. And then I feel like I have a niece and nephew, so it's like back to school season.
Yeah, you know what? I'm starting to see the advertisements already for shopping. And I'm probably even behind the game at that point, right?
We're like, I want to plan things for the end of April. My sister's like, or the end of August, and my sister's like, the kids will be back in school. And I'm like, what? Already?
It is a sad, sad time, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But the parents go, no, we're going to miss you. No, go.
Go to school.
I wanted to ask you something.
Yeah.
How do you feel about snakes?
I don't mind snakes at all.
No?
So, I was like a weird little kid who like loved reptiles.
Well, that's not weird. Me too.
Yeah.
I was the kid with the frog in my pocket and showing people everything, right? Well, I got to tell you one experience we did have.
Yeah.
First of all, I'm going to back up a little bit.
Yeah.
Discover NEPA now has a co-host.
I saw that.
Yes,
yeah,
Anna Bowles, and she's so sharp.
Yeah.
She was an intern for a while with us, and now she's come on board.
Cool.
And one of the first three or four stories she did was a rattlesnake hunt.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. And that's going to post it pretty soon, right?
Was that the roundup?
No, we didn't do the roundup. Okay. So one of the best rattlesnake hunters in the area has a Facebook page. It's Pennsylvania Hunting and Fishing Addicts.
Oh.
I don't know how 50,000 people follow. Yeah. But he's one of the most experienced rattlesnake hunters I know.
Wow.
And I reached out to him. His name is Bob Chase. And him and one of his buddies took us out. Right.
Yeah.
And they almost guaranteed that we'd find rattlesnakes. Sure as heck didn't we find rattlesnakes. We found four. We were able to catch two.
Yeah.
And there's a season, right? Middle of June until the end of July. That's it. You need a permit.
Dare I ask what you do with them?
So you're allowed to keep one
copperhead
and one rattlesnake.
Okay.
It's a venomous snake season, and that's the permit that you buy.
Yeah.
But there's certain rules. I believe that they've got to be over 46 inches long.
Oh, okay.
And they have to be a male,
yeah.
Right? And that's the interesting thing. How do you figure out if it's a male?
Right.
I'm taking the questions from you.
Yeah, yeah.
So what you do is you corral this snake on a flat piece of rock, and you get a plastic tube, and it's called tubing the snake. And you get it to slide halfway up its body up the tube, and then you grab it.
Yeah.
And now you can count the caudal scales to find out if it's a male or a female.
Yeah.
Now, experienced rattlesnake people could look at it and say the tail is a little stubbier. That's a female. The longer pointed ones is a male.
Yeah.
But you count the caudal scales.
So is that the scales like
from
on the...
from the rectum to the very tip of where it starts to rattle.
Yeah.
And anything over 23 inches is a male, and you could keep it.
Cool.
So yeah. But here's Anna. Anna didn't know what she's getting into. And I told her, I said, hold on, baby. We're rocking and rolling now. Yeah, so rattlesnake hunting. We found two that we tubed. Had an amazing experience for her.
Cool.
You know, and all the obvious questions like, how many rattles does it have? And, you know, how do you tell how old and all that kind of stuff? So that's posting on Go Wild with Discover NEPA. But Bob Chase was just absolutely amazing.
Bob Chase, I'm gonna have to hunt him down.
Hunting and fishing, Pennsylvania Hunting and Fishing Addicts, and he would gladly take you out.
I would love that.
Yeah,
that
and
so
that's
cool.
Why I'm telling you, because anytime I tell you something, you say, no, I haven't, but I love to, and I love that attitude in you.
Thank you.
That's really cool.
I just want to know everything there is to know about, like, what we can do in the great outdoors in Pennsylvania.
Isn't it the truth?
Yeah.
And here I am, I'm 65, and I never stop learning.
Yeah.
Like, I did rattlesnake hunt. I've been a rattlesnake hunter for several years.
Yeah.
And we did go to the Knoxon rattlesnake. You know, my buddies won it several times and all that. But I even with him, I learned something, like, out there. And I've been doing the outdoor things for, like, 40 years.
Right.
All my life, really, with my grandmother and grandfather and my father, I still learn.
Yeah.
And like you, I love your excitement. Like,
thanks.
What do you think about doing a rattlesnake? I'm in. Like, bring it on, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So totally an amazing trip with that. And that'll post on Go Wild with Discover NEPA.
Yeah.
But we've got so many neat things lined up and so many things we did since I saw you last, too.
Yeah, so tell me about the Eastern, I'm going to look at my paper.
Sure.
The Eastern Woodland Intertribal Powwow, and it was held at the Luzerne County Fairgrounds.
Yeah, so the people of the Eastern Door.
Mm-hmm.
Is a collection of the tribes of northeastern Pennsylvania and some of it the northeastern United States. And what I found fascinating is they are constantly trying to break the reputation they have of, you know, dancing around. Like, they dance, but everything's symbolic. But they want people to know they're not on horseback chasing cowboys,
right?
And there's so many myths out there about Native Americans. And what I found from talking to three or four members of that Eastern Door is their mission is to educate.
Mm.
So they hold this powwow, so the tribes can come and you know, collectively dance together and share their traditions. But more so, they want people that aren't Native American to come in and ask questions and watch as things go on and enjoy it.
Yeah.
And enjoy it. So that to me was amazing. And again, Anna was with me on that. She'd never been at a powwow. And you walk away pretty inspired, and then you could almost walk away embarrassed that you don't know what's going on there.
Right.
Yeah.
So there there was a lot of talk of the circle.
So everything's a circle, yeah. Right?
So we are going to hear a clip from People of the Eastern Door president Matt Clare, and he's going to tell us about the significance of the circle. So let's listen to that now.
Everything we do, Native people-wise, we do everything in a circle because there's no start, no end. It's just a continuous thing. So everything that you see about Native people, the medicine wheel, our dance circle, our everything, it's always in a circle. And people don't realize that. And that's why we try to do these powwows all over Pennsylvania, all over the United States, Canada. And it's to educate people, you know, educate that we're still here, but we adapted to what Europeans came and did.
So you danced.
I did.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was 95 degrees out,
mm-hmm.
and I was this close to not doing it. And then I looked, and there were people in their 90s,
mm-hmm.
veterans mm-hmm. in their 90s that were Native American. There were older women wearing such heavy clothes, sweating.
Yeah.
And they were dancing. Like, they wanted to share that.
Yeah.
And I grabbed Anna, and I said, they asked us to dance. Let's go get involved with that.
Yeah.
And about halfway around, I said to Anna, I get it. Like, I get that now there's a circle, but everybody's doing it together.
Mm-hmm.
And they invited other people, not just Native Americans. So I said, I get it. Like, if my grandkids are around next year, they're going to a powwow.
Yeah.
I want them to be part of that.
I actually had, Lake Wampalpak this month in July celebrated 100 years of existence.
Wow.
Which, you know, you grow up here, you know about Lake Wampalpak,
right.
And I guess you don't necessarily think about, its beginnings. So
yeah.
It really made me think about that. But I learned what Wampalpak means. So it's a Lenape word,
okay.
And it means stream of slow and steady waters.
Is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, to build Lake Wampalpak, they dammed the Wampalpak
yep.
River.
Man-made lake.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that was where, you know, the indigenous people who lived there had called it Wampalpak,
right.
Stream of Slow and Steady Waters. And I just find that, like, we have such an interesting, like, indigenous history.
Yeah,
like,
you're
all,
right.
All of our words, Wampalpak, Lackawanna, like,
Susquehanna,
Tunkhannock,
yep.
you know,
yep.
and I love learning those little tidbits about what those words actually mean.
Yeah, and in a way, we're naive
mm-hmm.
and we've been ignorant
mm-hmm.
because they were the first people.
Sure.
And there's even talk amongst Native Americans to ask people not to call them Native American. Ask them to call them the first people
mm-hmm.
because they were here.
Yeah.
Right? And we just took over modern society,
yeah.
whatever, and we sort of forgot that. So when somebody says, what's your ethnic background? I'm a proud Lithuanian,
yeah.
right? I love the kielbasis. Yeah. Bring on the halupkis. Bring on this.
Yeah.
And Native Americans are like that too, but
yeah.
you never really hear anybody say that.
Yeah.
So we're almost a little bit ignorant in that we don't ask them, well, what tribe?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And do you have any more existing relatives, ancestry here?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
kind of stuff. You know, and again, it's pretty embarrassing for us because I went to that knowing nothing about the circle.
Yeah.
Right? Nothing about why the eagle is so important.
Yes.
Right? And you learn.
Yeah. I mean, I found, the Go Wild segment to be so informational.
Yeah.
I didn't know about the eagle. I knew the circle had some significance, but to hear, like, Matt really talk about it was, you just learn.
You just learn, yeah.
Thanks to WVIA for that report. You can catch the rest of the full episode of Good Natured, if you're interested, up on their website and all the great reporting that they do out of Northeast Pennsylvania at WVIA.org. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, what's in store at the Delaware Highlands Conservancy in Beech Lake, Pennsylvania is up next.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You'll clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple. Free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
This week on Cat's Cast, I'm joined by Judy Van Putt and Nick Lyons to reflect on the life and legacy of Ed Van Putt, Catskills angler, author, and river steward, whose decades of stream surveys, fly fishing, and meticulous fieldwork is captured in his final book, Fly Fisher's Revelations: Practical Tips, Strategies, and Wisdom from 50 Years Experience. Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Kimberly Izar. You're listening to Farming Country. The Delaware Highlands Conservancy is gearing up for a packed September ahead, and many of them are happening right near their headquarters at the Van Scott Nature Reserve in Beech Lake, Pennsylvania. If you have not been there yet, oh my goodness, I really highly recommend checking it out. It is just simply gorgeous. There's lots of different trails to get lost on or not get lost on. I will often admittedly pick up a map and then not really use it and kind of just wander around when I get there. But you can really make it as short or as long as you want. It's such a beautiful place to kind of see the colors of the sky changing and just sit there. There's a couple benches throughout the various trails and listen to all of the pollinators in action. So earlier this week, I headed over there to catch up with Jen Campbell, the Conservancy's Education and Volunteer Coordinator, about upcoming programs this fall, from sunset walks to a meadow party. Tell me a little bit about where we are and what we're looking at.
Yeah, so my name is Jen Campbell. I am the Education and Volunteer Coordinator here for Delaware Highlands Conservancy. And our main headquarters is the Van Scott Nature Reserve in Beech Lake, Pennsylvania. Right now, it's drop-dead gorgeous with all the goldenrod blooming. We've got monarchs left, right, and center. I've been finding a ton of their caterpillars hanging around on our milkweed flowers. But the trails right now are just so beautiful. On a clear day, up at our pavilion, you can see three states, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. So it's really just a great place to get out and catch views, see a lot of wildlife, and a lot of plant life.
One of my favorite things about this reserve is that there's a lot of directions you can go in and a lot of different options in terms of trails. Are there any trails for you that really resonate?
I got here in April, and the first trail I fell in love with was our wildflower trail, which is right off of our parking lot. That was where I saw my first monarch of the season of 2026. So it is special to me because of that. But I've also just seen a ton of bird life out there. I've crept up on a little doe eating some breakfast. So there's a lot of wildlife scenes down there, and it's also dog friendly to the public. It's our only dog friendly trail, and it's also relatively flat. So it's good for little kids, good for adults that just want a quick stroll. So it's very, very variable in its uses.
And what's nice about this area is that there's like open fields, but then there's also kind of like a wooded shaded area, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So our woodland trail, which is kind of going off of our explorer trail. So it's, if you're looking at a map and you see colors going off the yellow onto the green trail, there is a forested area. There's a little bit of a off path little amphitheater where you can sit on some stumps and just enjoy nature nearby, but tons of tree life in there. There's also some signs of bear with some scratches on a tree out there, so it's
I haven't
awesome.
Seen any of those yet.
Yeah, luckily I have not come face to face with one on the reserve, but I do think that we have been seeing signs that they're around. They're hanging out here at night.
That's good to know. So I can't believe it, but we're already at the end of August. And I think for me, I'm holding on to the final few days and weeks of summer, but we're also kind of entering the autumn and fall season of just being here in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania, which is such a beautiful time of the year. Talk to me a little bit about some of the September programs. I know that you have a lot going on, maybe just a few that particularly come to mind.
Yeah, so we are continuing our wellness walk series. So we do have one morning and one sunset wellness walk. And I think that's a really great way to get to see the transition of seasons here at the Van Scott Nature Reserve.
During the Sunset Wellness Walk, we'll walk up to one of the highest points on the reserve, get to see the sun setting over some hopefully fall foliage. And then the morning walk is great to see. We're going to start to see some action of the migratory birds heading out, but they will still be around for that morning. So it's a peaceful morning. And then we, of course, have our Women in Their Woods retreat. We have that every other year. So this year, we're really excited to host it at Lucan's Farm Resort. We will have some species ID, forest ecology work, deer management work. There will be a chainsaw safety program. So that's a really amazing way to get women landowners around the region together, learning together, working together, and just in general, meeting others and having that sense of belonging in the forest.
And when are those programs? What are the dates for those?
Our Sunset Wellness Walk is on September 4th. Around 6:45 start, you'll get an email because sometimes sunset's unpredictable. Our morning walk around the reserve is September 26th. And then our Women in Their Woods retreat is on September 11th through 13th. So that's a full weekend, sleeping over or commuting, whichever you prefer. But that's a full weekend event.
And as you're planning for these upcoming events, how are you thinking about who these programs and events are for exactly?
I love to tailor my educational programming and all of our programming to everybody. So the wellness walks, they truly are for anybody that likes to walk around in nature. We keep a very moderate, slow pace, so kids with little legs or adults that want to come out, everyone can keep up. Women in Their Woods is mainly an adult event for women landowners. So don't think any kiddos are landowners quite yet. But then another big event we have is our Meadow Party, and that's on September 19th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And that is one of our biggest age ranges of events. So we really want adults, children, couples, parents, everybody involved.
Okay, so I love the name, Meadow Party. Tell me a little bit about what this looks like.
Yeah, so Meadow Party is to honor the tradition that our founder, Barbara Yeaman, had started. She was a lover of the meadows, and we are now so lucky to have the Vanscott Nature Reserve to be able to have now over 70 acres of meadows. So this day, this year, will look like a live animal presentation from ANA Critters. We will have a presentation about the monarch butterfly, its populations, what it needs to survive, how we can help support it in this time of need for that species. We will also have a hike around the reserve.
When is the Meadow Party again?
That's on September 19th. It's a 10 a.m. start to 2 p.m. It'll start off with some yoga, too. So we'll do some yoga down by one of our ponds, which is pretty peaceful. Good way to start the morning. And that's a kid-friendly, family-friendly yoga. So everyone can really get involved in that, which I love to see.
And, you know, I believe that all of the programs that you mentioned are, other than the Women in Woods retreat, are going to be here.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about what makes this space and this area so special for bringing the community together.
Yeah, we are so lucky to have such a unique landscape here. So, of course, in Northeast Pennsylvania and also across the river into New York, we live in a deciduous forest. You don't get to see such natural and healthy, thriving meadows the way you get to see at the Vanscott Nature Reserve. So the way we are able to support pollinator species, small mammals, tons and tons of bird species here at the reserve all in one space, it's truly something that I've never experienced until I got here. So that really makes the Vanscott Nature Reserve so incredibly special.
That's beautiful. And are there any other, it doesn't have to be specifically for September, but any other fall events that you and the team are starting to think about or starting to ideate on that you can give us a little bit of a sneak peek on?
I am hoping to have more live animal presentations, potentially Pocono Wildlife Rehabilitation. They do some educational programming. And then once we get deeper into fall, starting to help other landowners with maintaining their gardens and having a seed saving program and how to do that. Currently, right now, before September, our photo contest is open. So that is open through through August 31st. And that is available to adults. And then there's also a youth section for those under 18. Mm. But thinking deeper in, I'm hoping to have some permaculture design programming, some invasive control programming. So if you are a landowner looking to kind of better understand your land, wanting to manage your land, definitely look out for our land management programming that will occur year round.
And for, I guess, all of these events that you have coming up in the next, you know, month or two, is there anything that people should bring or come prepared with when they show up?
Yeah, for Meadow Party, if you're looking to stay the whole day, definitely bring a blanket and some lunch. That will be super enjoyable to have the whole day. There will be a sorbet truck here, so you'll get your sweet treat. Other than that, if you're coming to the Vanscott Nature Reserve for a hike or something, we do have some sloped terrain, so just make sure you've got some sturdy shoes on. If you prefer, you can always have hiking poles on our hikes. Definitely have your camera ready. I will say it's one of the most beautiful areas that I've been in the area. So, and that's not biased. So yeah, camera definitely, whether professional or your iPhone or whatever you have, bring that.
I think you may have sold a few of our listeners when you said the sorbet truck. Do you want to, Jen, let people know where people can find more information?
Absolutely. So we have an Instagram and a Facebook. On Instagram, we are DH Conservancy. On Facebook, you can just look up Delaware Highlands Conservancy. And then our website has absolutely everything you could ever need to know. So DelawareHighlands.org. And if you go to news and events, you can see our calendar of events there. And then there's just a bunch of other tabs. There's tabs on women in their woods, tabs for landowners, tabs on how to start the process of a conservation easement. So yeah, our website is definitely the most jam-packed with information.
A few happenings the next week. Today, Pines for Public Media is back. You can join Radio Catskill at Rose's Bar in Berryville later tonight. We're going to be there from 6 to 10 p.m. So will DJs James Friedman, Tommy Castro, and Woody Wood Jr. It's going to be such a fun night of music, friends. Beer is on you. Public radio is on all of us. Come support your local public radio station tonight. Again, that's going to be at Rose's Bar in Berryville from 6 to 10 p.m. And then tomorrow, Time and the Valleys Museum will host the Catskill Capers series book talk by Lily Barish Levner. This is a book talk on Levner's various books. The Whodunit series gives readers a bird's eye view of the dining room at the Concord Hotel, along with romance and a side of danger, set in the Catskills during its Borscht Belt heyday. That'll be tomorrow, Sunday, August 23rd at 2 p.m. at Time and the Valleys Museum in Grahamsville. And then on Thursday, August 27th, the New York DEC will hold a virtual meeting on potential changes to pesticide regulations and new regulations for Birds and Bees Protection Act. That'll be again on Thursday, August 27th at 9:30 a.m. Registration is required. You can find more information and events up on our website at wjffradio.org. That's going to do it for this week's show. This show was produced by the Radio Catskill editorial team and post-production by Ronald Nelson. Stick around. Up next, it's CatsCast with Brett Berry. You are listening to Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR. Catch you next week.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
Although the Justice Department has published thousands of pages of the Epstein files, the quest for accountability goes on.
There are huge pages of redactions that involve descriptions of activity by other possible co-conspirators, whether they be powerful men, we don't know because they're all blacked out.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it's food for kids. That's anything but kids' food. We talk with renowned chef and, more importantly, dad, David Nayfeld. And we have the most majestic cookbook ever written about instant ramen. No, really, it's great. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill. WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.